This is Tax Update Podcast for Saturday, February 25th, 2006. This week's tax update, medical expenses and the spouse employee. Tax Update Podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and the document may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the audio file. Such prohibited use would include using the podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The Tax Update Podcast is sponsored this week by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information for tax professionals who subscribe to their service. Again, visit them on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. This week, we're going to take a look at what may be a rather mundane area of the tax law, but is somewhat important, and that deals with medical expenses. And we're looking at it this week because a tax court summary opinion came down that outlines how to set up a medical reimbursement plan for a spouse employee. Now, as we'll talk about, this obviously is a summary case and therefore is not cited as, cannot be cited as precedent. It's not technically binding on the tax court to arrive at the same decision in the future, but it is still an interesting analysis of the actual application of the law to the facts and gives us a chance to discuss the basic aspects of the plans and how to make them work. We'll first, though, discuss the more general rule of what is a medical expense under the Internal Revenue Code. Now, Section 213 of the Internal Revenue Code controls what is a medical expense. And we're going to take a look at the basic issues that come under here. But the first problem we run into is, in general, Section 213 appears to be of less than overwhelming use, because, as we are made aware of almost right away when we start reading under Section 213A, that our medical expenses, whatever they must be to get a benefit, must exceed 7.5% of adjusted gross income. If the medical expense ends up on Schedule A, we have the 7.5% limitation to deal with. That means the actual deduction via 213 quite often does not have much of a positive impact on a taxpayer. In fact, quite often, the reality is their expenses are below 7.5% of adjusted gross income. Therefore, no tax benefit incurs if it ends up having to go through Schedule A. For that reason, medical expense reimbursements or medical insurance, other favored methods of receiving your medical care under the tax law, have to be looked at, those that escape going through the Schedule A routine. What we find rather quickly, though, is that many of the provisions that give us a break for medical expenses of some sort still refer back to our definitions under 213 as to what is a medical expense. For that reason, even if we can't get the 7.5% benefit, it's important to know what comes under the rules of medical expense under Section 213, because that's going to impact the expenses that can be paid from a flexible spending account, can be paid via a health savings arrangement, or can be paid via the medical reimbursement plan structure we're going to talk about in this week's tax court case. Now, the actual definition that we find is going to be under Section 213D. Now, I'll add as a quick aside, since we have a number of people from Arizona who listen, yes, I know, under Arizona law, we actually get a deduction for the medical expenses for state tax purposes, even if we don't clear the 7.5% limitation. However, even for an Arizona resident, it's still somewhat useful, more useful, to get your medical expenses paid for in a way that has them escape inclusion in income or allows you to get a deduction effectively without that 7.5% limit, because even if it may not make a real difference at the state level, the federal marginal rate for most of our clients is significantly higher. Now back to the provisions that everybody would worry about who's not in Arizona or who has a non-Arizona client, and even a few of us in Arizona have non-Arizona clients. The general definition of what is a medical expense is found in Section 213(d)(1). That section gives us four classes of medical care, what medical care is, which we will be able to take a medical deduction for under Section 213, or at least initially may. Now, three of them we'll get rid of quickly. The second, third, and fourth we'll talk about just briefly here. Transportation, primarily for and essential to medical care, is a deductible medical expense. It's medical expense under 213(d)(1b). D1C, qualified long-term care services as defined in section 7702 uppercase B, C. So long-term care is a medical expense. That's under section 213(d)(1c). And section 213(d)(1d) for insurance, including amounts paid as premiums under Part B of Title 18 of the Social Security Act relating to supplementary medical insurance for the aged, otherwise meaning Medicare Part B, covering medical care referred to or any qualified long-term care contract, again under 7702 cap BB. So we get insurance. Those are fairly specific, and two of them refer to definitions that are in other parts of the code that we won't go into here. But the generic definition is really the one that's primarily of interest to us, because that's the one that we get a lot more worried about and which causes us where most of our items are going to end up falling. And that's a definition found in section 213(d)(1a). That definition says medical care will include amounts paid for the diagnosis, cure, mitigation, treatment, or prevention of disease, or for the purpose of affecting any structure or function of the body. So basically we have two categories. We have the treatment of a disease, or we have an amount paid to affect the structure or function of the body. If it falls into those categories, subject to some additional limitations, we will find that we get a medical expense deduction, or at least it's considered medical care under this term, and subject to some limitations would give you a deduction under 213. Now, many of us may be used to long lists and quick reference books of items that do qualify and items that don't qualify for the medical expense deduction. In fact, that's fairly normal that we find that in all kinds of reference materials, from the quick reference guides like the Quick Finders all the way through the Master Tax Guides and other documents that are used for reference purposes. And unfortunately, that leads to a belief among some preparers and some tax professionals that basically there's some perfect checklist here of medical expenses. The reality is, and it's important to understand from a research perspective, those checklists are generally generated by case law and rulings that dealt with the specific application of Section 213(d)(1a) and telling us either what the court or the IRS believed that meant. One caveat, those lists are very useful and very helpful, and I do not discount them as being something that you never should refer to. But understand that you still have to take a look at your client's specific facts as applied to the actual wording in the code, understanding that your client's facts may be slightly different from the facts that were dealt with in the ruling or the case, and you may find that your client's answer, therefore, will not be the simple yes-no answer that the checklist approach might lead you to believe can be done very quickly by going down this list of what's in and what's out. Let's take a look then at this two-part definition. Let's first consider what's basically a payment for the diagnosis, cure, mitigation, treatment, or prevention of a disease. The key issue initially there, since we have a lot of categories we could be spending relating to a disease, is what is a disease? Disease has become an important concept here, and generally the IRS and the courts have looked to medical definitions of what constitutes a disease. A good example in that area came in 2002, when we had a significant change of position by the IRS that needs to be taken a look at. In 2002, in the revenue ruling issued then, we had what we would call the Jenny Craig ruling, shall we say, that essentially said that on a weight loss program, the IRS would now take the position that amounts paid for a weight loss program, but not the amounts paid for foods from that weight loss program, would be considered a deductible medical expense. We got the deduction. In the past, the IRS position had been it was not deductible. What was the distinction? The IRS noted that they now felt that the preponderance of evidence in the medical community, or the preponderance of opinion in the medical community, was that obesity was now a disease. If a client, if a taxpayer is diagnosed medically as being obese and is referred for the treatment of the obesity to participate in one of these programs, now you have an amount paid for the treatment of a disease. As such, that payment becomes deductible. The food you lose, even though it's related to this and may be very important in the weight reduction, but you lose because the IRS views that as a personal nature expense that is not necessarily something that would be required by the program, from the idea that you still have to eat anyway, whether or not you eat from the program foods or not, that's a separate and a personal non-medical expense. And while it may be helpful in guiding you to make sure that you eat the right things to control the obesity, it is not a required item. Previously, before the diagnosis of obesity as a disease was accepted by the IRS, the IRS position was that these fell into a category where a lot of expenses get trapped and are non-deductible. Basically, the regulations tell us that under Regulation 1.213-1, you find that we're told that basically a payment that just improves a taxpayer's general health and well-being is not a medical expense. For instance, signing up for a membership in your local health club may help you, presuming you participate in the activities, you exercise, you do all of the things they suggest doing. It's probably good for you. But merely being good for you or helping your general health isn't good enough, because you are not treating a specific disease. If you have the same fact pattern, but the taxpayer is sent to the health club because of a specific disease for which the health club, there is a specific form of treatment that is going to require that, then you may have an argument. But just generically, I think you should go to a health club because I think you just need to kind of get in better shape. That reference from the physician probably won't cut it. Now, the second definition we run into is a payment that affects any structure or function of the body. This function or structure test is used for expenditures that don't deal with a disease per se, but still have functional difference. In reproductive areas is where we've seen a lot of items in this regard. For instance, there have been rulings that will tell us that we do get a medical deduction for payments for a vasectomy, payments for an abortion, and payments for, in a separate ruling the IRS came down, that an operation that rendered a woman incapable of having children was also a medical expense under these rules. In none of these cases do you treat a disease per se. There's no disease here sitting here. No diagnosed disease is probably causing these expenditures. But because the expenditures affects the function or structure of the body, that becomes the reason why it becomes deductible. Now, there are some important exceptions to the deductions for these items. First, if the treatment is illegal, Regulation 1.213-1E2 prohibits a deduction for illegal medical treatment. So if your client uses a drug that is not approved or is not allowed to be sold in the United States, that is an illegal treatment, and that cannot be deducted even if it has medically beneficial effects. For instance, the IRS used that in the past year in an informal ruling that pointed out that if you buy your drugs over the border, you go to Mexico or Canada to buy prescription drugs because they're significantly cheaper there, and then bring them back in the country, well, that's in violation of the FDA rules at this point. Because it's in violation of federal law as interpreted by the FDA, the IRS holds that the payments for those prescription drugs are non-deductible. Another important exception that many of us probably are aware of, and you may have wondered where it's at right now because we haven't discussed it, is, wait, the definition you just gave would seemingly, though, when we talked about definitions for treatments of a disease or function of the body, well, you know, I've got a cold and I'm taking over-the-counter decongestants and over-the-counter antihistamine, over-the-counter aspirin. But I thought you couldn't deduct that. Correct, you cannot. But it is not the definition of medical care that blocks that. And that becomes important because many of the provisions that give us a break that go outside of the Schedule A deduction don't refer to this provision. They refer to the broad definition of medical care. Therefore, you may remember rulings that told us that we could reimburse for non-prescription drugs in a flexible spending account or a health savings account. We can do a medical reimbursement plan that will pay for them. Why? Because all of these provisions refer to Section 213D when referring to what is medical care. The prohibition on the deduction of non-prescription drugs is found in Section 213B. Section 213B says an amount paid during a taxable year for medicine or a drug shall be taken into account under subsection A, which is the deduction on Schedule A. Key caveat, the only place we see it. Only if such medicine or drug is a prescribed drug or insulin. This became important because it does mean it's not just the Schedule A medical expenses that could be reimbursed by a flexible spending account, can be reimbursed under a medical reimbursement plan. Instead, we have a somewhat broader category of medical expenses because those references go to 213D, not just to 213 as a whole, not just to those items that would be allowable deductions under 213, but for the 7.5% limitation. Now, as noted, that 7.5% limitation becomes a bit of a problem and causes us all kinds of nightmares when trying to deal with tax implications and trying to get some benefit for medical expenses. So what we'd really like to do is find some way to deduct those expenses. Better. We'd also like to find a way to help with medical expenses of a sole proprietor. Now, in a prior podcast, we talked about setting up a medical reimbursement plan in a corporate structure, a C corporation, where we discussed the fact that if you had a C corporation, you have a taxpayer who basically is the only employee of the entity, or there are very few employees, that you could set up a qualified medical reimbursement plan, and the taxpayer could participate in that plan and have their medical expenses reimbursed to the extent that they are a employee of the C corporation. We also noted, though, that that benefit is not allowed to sole proprietors or partners or greater than 2% shareholders in S corporations, because in all of those cases, you are not allowed to consider that person to be an employee for purposes of the plan. Therefore, such reimbursements become essentially additional income or special allocations, guaranteed payments to a partner. And then the deduction goes back to Schedule A with a 7.5% limitation. Not a good result. One of the methods that was discussed to try and get around this problem has been to use a procedure that actually the IRS has even suggested was fine in a revenue ruling that we had back in the 70s. And that is that if I, as a sole proprietor, hire my spouse as an employee, legitimately hire, my spouse really does something, is a real employee, I can provide a medical reimbursement plan for my employees, meaning my spouse, and that medical reimbursement plan can then pay for the medical expenses of that person that would be allowed to be paid for by the employer, which can be the medical expenses of that person and that person's dependents, which could include the sole proprietor now under a different hat. So we've seen some activity there. Now, this week we had a case come down where the taxpayers had set up such a plan and the IRS had challenged it. It is a summary opinion. Therefore, again, not precedential. Very important. But this case gives us a lot of facts that tells you what you need to look at. This case is also probably important because you need to realize it tells us the IRS will challenge this structure in some cases. And I think when you look at the fact pattern here, you're going to find that this fact pattern was such that a lot of us probably would have assumed the IRS wouldn't probably have challenged this one. There's a lot worse situations sitting out there. So it is cautionary for your clients that even though, quote unquote, the good guys won the case, reality is that if your facts don't look this good, you may have some trouble because the court did seriously consider many of the IRS's positions and held for the taxpayer based on the taxpayer's evidence, which if your evidence isn't as good, you could lose this plan. But conceptually, as we said, the idea is we hire our spouse. The case in question that we had this week is Speltz versus Commissioner, Tax Court Summary 2006-25. Now, Mrs. Speltz ran a daycare business where she took care of children. And she is properly licensed by the state. She was the licensed person, and it was her business that she was running. Mr. Speltz worked a full-time job in addition to working in the daycare center. He was basically a part-time employee, as Mrs. Speltz had it, for the daycare center. He assisted in the daycare center, but he was still nevertheless an employee under her position. And in consultation with a tax advisor, they set up a medical reimbursement plan where Mrs. Speltz agreed to provide medical reimbursement plan for her employee, who in this case was her husband, and her employee therefore got that pay, in this case, in fact, in lieu of any salary. There was no salary paid to Mr. Speltz in this case. Mr. Speltz received his medical reimbursement plan. Now, frankly, that fact right there may be part of the reason why the IRS went after this one. I'll be honest, having no salary whatsoever raised probably the question initially about the medical expenses and, from a practical standpoint, on exam got us down the whole road for this case and how we got as far as we did before it finally got decided. But it was nevertheless that Mrs. Speltz had agreed with her husband, and basically they put together three documents that became crucial in this case. Now, they executed an employment agreement that provided Mr. Speltz would work for the daycare center an average of 12.5 hours a week in exchange for medical coverage limited to $6,500 per year. They signed a salary redirection agreement that provided that $542 per month would be redirected to a flexible spending account to be used for Mr. Speltz's medical care. The employer would fund the account for Mr. Speltz, or the accounts would get funded. And the client data sheet was a third document, and it required that Mr. Speltz work a minimum of 12.5 hours a week and a minimum of 7 months a year. Now, those were the three documents. One key difference, note, the client data sheet said that Mr. Speltz had to work a minimum of 12.5 hours a week. The employment agreement said an average. That did become somewhat important when we started arguing in court. At least the IRS certainly went after it on that issue in one case. Well, the IRS attacked the plans on a number of fronts. First, they tried to argue that the plan wasn't real because it wasn't written. However, the court quickly dismissed that written. It noted that a medical reimbursement plan does not technically have to be written. In fact, the main thing is here, as the court noted, citing a number of cases, that there need not be a written plan or enforced or even enforceable employee rights under the plan, so long as the participant has notice or knowledge of this plan. And I should add, operationally, it still qualifies with the requirements under 105. You can't be discriminatory, you've got to cover the right people, etc. But basically, the plan can be highly informal, the court said, as long as you can show that the employee knew of the plan and basically had proper notice given. So the IRS, of course, is claiming no proper plan. The IRS second question, if it was a proper plan, that the notice or knowledge of the plan was not reasonably available to Mr. Speltz. And finally, they argued that he didn't meet his contractual obligations under the client data sheet to work 12.5 hours each week. And at the end, the IRS argued, in any event, he was not an employee of the daycare center. Now, as noted, the court did find there was a proper plan. Noted the daycare accident health plan is detailed in the client data sheet, which gave the effective date of when the benefits would come, that he was entitled to $6,500 a year, and that they had to work a minimum of 12.5 hours a week to be eligible to receive benefits. On that basis, the court found there was a plan. Now, the IRS attempted to claim that, well, Mr. Speltz didn't know about the plan. That, to me, seems to be a very, very, very strained argument at best by the IRS. In fact, tongue-in-cheek, I would suggest to the IRS Office of Professional Responsibility, this position may be a perfect example of the very type of, you know, frivolous, shall we call them, position that, if it was pushed by a taxpayer, may very well get the taxpayer's advisor into trouble with the IRS. But nevertheless, we'll still consider this. The court dealt with that one rather quickly. Court, simple notice. We disagree with the IRS position that he didn't have notice. Mr. Speltz signed a document indicating the salary would be in the form of reimbursements for insurance premiums and medical expenses up to $6,500 a year. He credibly testified he had knowledge of the plan and, most importantly, or the court essentially saying to the IRS, you idiot, Mr. Speltz used the plan. If he didn't know it was there, how could he have used it? Therefore, the court dismissed this theory that he didn't have notice of the plan. They said the plan, there was obviously notice. Therefore, we find that Mr. Speltz, the court said, had notice and knowledge of the plan. Now, the IRS was concerned about the inconsistency in the documents. They claim because the client data sheet, which was the plan, indicated that he had to work 12.5 hours a week, that meant that every week he had to work 12.5 hours to be eligible to be in the plan, and that if he worked less than 12 and a half hours in any week, he was not covered under the plan, and therefore, for that reason, operationally, he should be excluded from, he'd be excluded from the plan operationally. Being excluded from the plan operationally would mean that essentially he's not in there, it wasn't paid under the plan, and we're back to Schedule A. The court essentially said, well, we understand your point, but we think the documents taken as a whole indicate that they met an average because the employment agreement said you're going to work an average of 12.5 hours. We don't think it's inconsistent, the court basically said, or we don't think it is a coincidence that 12.5 reappeared in the medical plan. We think it's meant to have the same definition in both, and we think that while the data sheet is not totally clear as to whether that meant you had to work 12.5 every week or whether it was an average computed in some form, the court felt that ambiguity could be resolved in favor of average by looking at the other documents. Now, this raises a couple of important points, even though the taxpayer won the case. The documents are not just little things to be ignored or to be signed and filed away and never worried about again. When push came to shove, when an actual case went before the courts, those documents became important. And I would suggest that probably if the Speltzes had their things to do over again, they probably would have suggested, or their advisor would have decided, it would have been best to make sure those two 12.5 references said the same thing. Would have saved a bit of a problem. But it's also important to note that the court legitimately expects you to follow them. The Speltzes did follow the 12.5 average hours. They had lots of records that backed this up. The court clearly found that he worked at least that much. The court clearly was decided that his legitimate work for the daycare business was probably substantially in excess of 12.5 per week. But the court did pay attention to the document. If you are implementing one of these plans with a client, it's very, very important that the client understand that if the plan that you've adopted and you sit down and you get a medical reimbursement plan. And I have seen this suggestion given by people. I've seen people just ask for them. You know, somebody have a copy of a plan I can just, you know, implement or use. Well, that's fine. But realize whatever plan you do claim to have implemented, you better follow the terms of it. If that plan requires the employee be there 12 hours a week, it would be really nice to have documentation that the spouse worked 12 hours a week rather than just assuming the spouse did or letting that go through under that circumstance that somehow the spouse really didn't matter. 12 hours a week, we can ignore that. That's a mere technicality. Had the Speltz has not been able to show that he worked 12.5 hours a week minimum or convince the court that was the case, they would have probably lost this case. Don't let them ignore it. Don't treat these plan documents like you do an end user licensing agreement that pops up anytime, you know, you try to install a piece of software. That little box that pops up that has, you know, goes on forever. You scroll through it and there's reams of paper, if you print it out, that comes out and gives you all the restrictions on using the software, which everybody conveniently ignores and just clicks OK, I accept it. You have to realize this document, this plan document, will be important if you're going to defend this from a later attack. Finally, the most important feature and the biggest argument is going to be, was Mr. Speltz truly an employee? The court spent a lot of time analyzing this issue in the decision. The Speltz had a lot of documentation to back them up on this one. Frankly, they had a lot more than many clients are going to have. That documentation proved to be very important. Key issue, Mrs. Speltz had the right to control Mr. Speltz's activities. This is the big smell test. Does it look like she really was in charge of him? If he's her partner, that isn't going to help. In that case, he's not an employee. He's a partner or an equity controlling owner. He's making he's doing the managerial, the top level decisions. This is going to be a problem because somebody in that position would not get the deduction. However, the court did find that in this case, Mrs. Speltz appeared to clearly be in charge. She was a licensed individual. She was the individual who really did the work for the most part. Again, remember, Mr. Speltz worked most of the day. She was there taking care of it. She was the front end of this thing. She was the one that clients figured was the one in charge. And she truly appeared to be in charge. In essence, everything fell in place for her to truly control her husband in this position as an employee. Note, if that had not been the case, you need to be very concerned. Clients shouldn't think it's just a simple fact of saying, oh, Joe's on the payroll, and then we can do whatever we want, or Joe's an employee. You had better be able to show a true employer-employee relationship here. The Speltzes had records of Mr. Speltz's actual work. Mrs. Speltz's calendar documented when Mr. Speltz would be working in the center. It was great. It was contemporaneous. It showed exactly what was going on. She would quite often have him take care of the children if she had to go out and do things for the center, during the day, wait till he got home. He would take care of the kids and do that. He also had other functions that he did to watch kids or take care of kids. Mrs. Speltz noted where those things were going. She kept very good records, and those records were incredibly important in this case. And the court found this case distinguishable from cases where no true employment relationship existed. You should probably review those cases that are brought up in the Speltz case if you have a client who wants to put their spouse on the payroll, and it becomes difficult to figure out what the spouse is really doing. If you have a smell problem, take a look at those cases and perhaps introduce your client to the cases referenced. In the materials this week, I have reproduced the entire Speltz case decision. You can read it over and find the references here. What does this mean going forward? Well, it says that it is possible to use this sort of plan in a proprietorship. It also tells us from a cautionary standpoint that the IRS will challenge this setup. Remember, while the Spelts won, that's nice and good, and we like that result. But reality is, I'm sure the Spelts would have preferred had the IRS never questioned it and had they just gotten a pass on it immediately on the exam. So your clients do need to understand that the IRS apparently will take this all the way through to court. At least in this case, they did. As well, remember, this doesn't work in the case for things like S corporations. Why doesn't it work for an S corporation? Spousal attribution. If this was an S corporation that Mrs. Speltz owned, even if in a community property state like Arizona, it was separate property of Mrs. Speltz, or you were in a non-community property state and it clearly was her property and he had no ownership interest in it, we have the attribution rules that would treat Mr. Speltz as a greater than 2% owner of the S corporation and would disqualify him. This only works for proprietorships. It will not work for corporations. Keep that in mind. Third, remember that it does prove that these are useful techniques for doing it. If you dot your I's and cross your T's, you can successfully set up such a plan. As I noted, my suspicion is that had Mr. Speltz actually had a salary, you could have stopped this much earlier. I think one of our problems in this case was that Mr. Speltz had no salary, didn't show up as a W-2 employee, and that got us down the road to the point where we ended up in the courts over whether or not the plan was valid. Now, it is important to note the court did take a look at, we take a look at the benefits Mr. Speltz got for his medical expenses, and we take a look at what he did for the company, and we want to see if that's a reasonable salary. It reminds us that reasonable compensation is not just W-2 wages. It includes benefits. Therefore, again, if you just think it's a mechanical issue of, oh, I'm putting my spouse on the payroll, even though he or she never gets near my office and never gets near my business, won't ever be seen or works 1 hour a year, you know, covered the phones one morning because the receptionist was out, so covered the phones for 2 hours and now is going to be paid $6,000 in compensation for those 2 hours effectively through the medical reimbursement plan. It's not going to fly. As well, remember the general rule when we're analyzing medical expenses, go back and look at the code and remember the two-part definition essentially for the major categories of medical expenses. Are we treating a disease? Are we affecting the function of a part of the body? If we do either of those, that gets it in. If we don't do those, we're out. General welfare and benefits don't count. This has been the Tax Update Podcast for Saturday, February 26, 2006. Hopefully everybody's having a good tax season so far. We're now heading right into the meat of the season coming up here shortly. For all of us and our clients will actually believe here shortly it's time to start worrying about when to get their 1040s filed. So I'm sure a number of you are spending extra time these days working on this. Also thought I would mention that we did get published the Arizona Tax Guides for the Phoenix Tax Workshop at aztax.org. I was one of the authors on the Arizona Tax Guide this year, the Arizona Income Tax Guide, not the other guides, income tax only for me. And that is available there. If you're interested, you can go to their website to purchase copies of that. They're still available. Remind you again that this podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Services. Lineberg Information Services, providing newsletters of interest to tax professionals, found on the web at www.linebergservices.com. We will hopefully be back to you next week when we enter into March and that fun part of the year and start heading into the month before the month that ends tax season. And we start approaching rapidly, though, the due date for corporate filings for calendar year corporations. So we'll get those parts together. Next week, though, hopefully we'll find a new topic to discuss. This has been Tax Update for Saturday, February the 25th, 2006.